Excuse me, everyone. We now have all of our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Alyssa Ayers. Ms. Ayers, you may begin.
Thank you, Todd. Hi, everyone. We're so glad that you're able to join us this morning for a conversation on India's coronavirus vulnerabilities and response. This is now the new conference call mode of my standing U.S. Relations with South Asia Roundtable series. I hope to be able to do more roundtable events like this, either by conference call or by video conference. We're adapting our own processes for this new world that we find ourselves in. And I hope everybody on the call is doing well and staying safe and healthy in all of our time of social distancing. I'm just delighted to be able to welcome to today's roundtable Dr. Ramanan Lakshminarayan, who is the founder and director of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy, as well as Tom Boyke, who, as many of you likely know, is the director of the Global Health Program and senior fellow for Global Health, Economics, and Development here at the Council on Foreign Relations. I can't imagine a better combination of experts to talk with us today, not only about the broad landscape of what coronavirus means and the way it's having an effect on all of us around the world, and then a deep dive on how this is unfolding in India and what to expect. You will all have received in your meeting packets by email a link to a document with their more extended bios, so you all have that. You'll see that they both are extremely well-positioned to be able to talk with us today. I would, as a final note before I ask Tom to provide some introductory remarks, I just want to remind everybody that this call is on the record. We don't always do our roundtables on the record, but we're doing this one in that way. So thanks very much again for being able to join us. Thank you to Dr. Lakshminarayan and to Tom Boyke. And Tom, if I could just turn things over to you and ask you to help us set the stage globally for this moment that we are in.
Great. Thank you for that kind introduction, Alyssa, and it's a pleasure to be on the call here with Dr. Lakshminarayan. The eyes of the nation, of course, are on what's happening here domestically with COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, but we mustn't lose sight of what's happening abroad on this pandemic. If it wasn't obvious to you already, it should be obvious by now that no country is going to escape this pandemic. There are now approximately 1.5 million reported cases of COVID-19 in over 180 countries and territories. We're all likely somewhere on the same epidemic curve together. A handful of nations are ahead of us and slowing, like Italy and Japan, and then there are others behind us, like India, that are growing rapidly. U.S. policymakers and the public would do well in surmounting this terrible outbreak if we learn from those ahead of us and behind us on that curve. That's in part for those ahead of us because our models are informed, our disease models, our expectations based on what's going to happen on this pandemic are informed about what's happened abroad in places ahead of us like China and elsewhere. And it's good to be explicit about what we know about those settings and where the limitations are. What's happening behind us matters also because what has become clear is that this pandemic, until there is a widely deployed vaccine, is going to be with us for the long haul. Even countries ahead of us are starting to suffer resurgences from imported cases, and learning from those behind us are going to be relevant for how the U.S. handles similar circumstances when and if we get to that point. Beyond that, India matters, of course, for other reasons. It's a hugely populous nation, 1.4 billion people. It has a great strategic importance to the U.S. as well. But from a global health perspective, what's happening in India may be more predictive of what's going to come in this pandemic than what we've seen here domestically in the U.S. The U.S. from an issue of, I'm going to name three issues there that I'm watching that I think are going to be relevant. The first is on the urban dimension of this pandemic. The U.S. has had somewhat of an odd experience in that regard, where we've really had four different settings be hit by this pandemic: large, dense, superstar cities like New York, industrial centers connected through supply chains like Detroit, tourist meccas, ski communities, the Hamptons, and the like, and also small and vulnerable populations. But in other settings, what may end up mattering are more your traditional concerns around urbanization of deeply populous and dense environments, and India certainly has those, and in particular, large informal urban settlements, slums, which are going to be relevant both for their own experience, but from what we might expect in sub-Saharan Africa or North Africa, other settings, as well as this pandemic spreads there. The second issue that I'm watching is chronic diseases. Age is certainly a critical factor, but so are comorbidities, other illnesses that people have. To some extent, these issues have been lumped together in the U.S. because in New York, for instance, many of those who have succumbed to this disease have been both older and having these comorbidities. India, of course, has a younger population, but also a high level of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, as low- and middle-income countries go, that might be more predictive, again, of what we're going to see in the future in other nations. The last issue I'll raise before turning it over is health systems. India, and this is where India, I think, may have a lot to teach the world, historically has been a country that has been able to innovate on healthcare delivery at large volumes and low cost, and adapt to more limited circumstances better than most other nations of the world. What India does in response to this pandemic, I think, may set some very useful models and useful lessons, not just for other low- and middle-income countries, but for how we might be able to start to provide services at scale as well. And with that, I'm really looking forward to the remarks of Dr. Lakshmi Narayan, and let me turn it over to him to take it from there.
Thanks, Tom.
Hi. So thanks for the kind introduction and also for laying out the lay of the land in terms of where India stands, and lots of similarities, of course, with what may happen in some other countries. So let me begin at the beginning. India had its first case on January 30th, from three students who arrived from Wuhan. This was part of evacuation flights, and the students were medical students, and then they were quarantined, and India really didn't have any more cases for the, at least none that we were aware of, for another month after that. But even right after that, flights to China were stopped, as soon as, somewhere in mid-January itself. And then the actual wave of cases that seeded the epidemic in India came in the form of tourists from Italy. Obviously, Italy was unaware that it had an epidemic going on right there, and Italian tourists had arrived, and, there were clusters of them that showed up. One cluster in Jaipur, which is a tourist area, and then there were other people who came into India from outside of the country. And in response, India had airport screenings, not particularly effective because airport screenings are terrible for coronavirus just because most people are asymptomatic, but they felt they had to do that. But very soon there were restrictions on anyone from abroad coming into the country, and then, soon after they completely stopped, issuing visas and so forth. And, of course, during the lockdown, all flights were also canceled. Now, it's impossible to really stop the virus from getting into India, as it is impossible to stop it from getting into the U.S. just because it's a large country, about 80,000 arrivals every day from Europe, but also from the Gulf states where transmission had started already in February. And India has a large expat population in the Gulf states. So, for instance, in countries like Qatar, there are more Indians there than are actual Qataris. And these folks all came back to Kerala. There were people who went back to other parts of India, and, you know, absolutely impossible to figure out who had the virus and who did not. Now, all of this unfolded, obviously, rather quickly after March 1st, and we're literally just about 5 weeks after that. And nothing much happened, really, in terms of preventing transmission within the country, because India was treating it as if this was going to be a case where you could use, track, trace, and contain epidemiology, where you look at someone coming in, look at their contacts, and then see if you can isolate their contacts and quarantine. So part of this method was simply because India doesn't have the testing infrastructure within the government setup. It just was not ready to expand this out into the private sector either. But obviously, for a country the size of India, it's practically impossible to prevent, transmission into the community. So for a long time, India was also amongst the lowest, on the test table, people testing for COVID. At one point, it was actually literally the lowest of any large country except for Indonesia, which I believe still lags India. And, all this continued, but of course there was more seriousness about social distancing. Hard to do in India, except if you have the space to do it, because if you're in a slum and 20 people living in a house, how in the world do you socially distance or physically distance? There were appeals that were made by the government to not have religious gatherings and weddings and so forth, but people really didn't pay attention. I mean, everything continued. Of course, some people, scaled back and some offices shut, but not everyone was really in compliance. And the only option out really was that, India had to sort of, until that point, it was also a bit of the narrative to say that India is different. This is something that only in the Northern Hemisphere, India is warm, so maybe the virus won't be here, or maybe we're different. We're already exposed to lots of other diseases, so coronavirus is something that we're already immune to, or we have, other sort of cures for these, whatever it might be. Now, that narrative started falling apart quite quickly once it became quite clear that Indians can and do actually get infected. And of course, there were these issues about India having high rates of hypertension and diabetes. About a third of India's adults are hypertensive, and about a tenth of India's adults are diabetic. And then you also have the issue of respiratory illness. Even the best of times, India has high rates of pneumonia, poor air quality. So lungs are not great. And when it comes to respiratory disease, this is not really the place that you want to take a chance. So the initial estimates which we had come up with were, not dissimilar to what nearly every other modeling group said, which is about 25% of the population will be infected. Not all with symptomatic infections, but, most of them would be asymptomatic or with mild infections. But this is roughly ballpark for any country if you are not going to apply the brakes on with a lockdown. But even, if that were to be the flow, then the estimate was that there would be about 10 million people with severe disease at the peak, most of whom would have to be hospitalized. Now, 10 million patients with severe disease was just way too much compared to what the Indian system has. India has about 100,000 intensive care beds and somewhere between 20 and 50,000 ventilators, still unclear where that really is. But whatever it is, even if you have 50,000 ventilators, you can't take care of 10 million patients, and you can't take care of them with 100,000 intensive care unit beds. So this is where India sort of stepped in and said, listen, or the government stepped in and said, we're not going to take this hit on the public health side. Although it wasn't officially expressed that way, I think it was very clear that a lockdown was really the only solution, and a few options were thought about, but there were challenges with doing a lockdown only in some states and not in some other states, getting everyone to take the message seriously, and therefore India just imposed what I would consider a hard lockdown. And I have to say, even I'm surprised. It's something which you don't think is possible in a country like India, which is, in the best of times can be chaotic and people don't really follow rules. But, this lockdown seems to have really achieved the purpose of not having people out in public spaces. So for the most part, there have been a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, that's actually happened. Now, the flip side of this is, of course, that the lockdown was imposed rather hastily. And, to some extent, it's excusable because these are, decisions that are being made on the fly. And the consequences of waiting a few days could have also been quite large, and it's important to shut down when the contagion had not spread too much. At the point at which India locked down, there were fewer than 500 cases and just about 10 deaths. Literally no country, and none of that size, would have or had locked down based on such a small case number. But it was pretty obvious to the folks working on this that this is just the tip of the iceberg, and it's probably going to be much higher than this. Our own estimate was that at the time of the lockdown, there were probably about 21,000 cases, although obviously a large proportion asymptomatic, but asymptomatics also transmit, so it doesn't really help you that much. So that was the whole idea, and then we, India's been in lockdown since, the 24th of, do I have the date right? I've lost track of dates, sorry.
25th.
It's 26th, okay, 25th, one of those dates. And it doesn't open up till April 14th. April 14th night is when it actually opens up again. So that was a three-week lockdown, which is what, is generally recommended. The economy has taken, obviously, has tanked. Employment has dropped because unemployment rates have gone up a significant amount. There are not official figures on this because India doesn't really do unemployment the way the U.S. does, but all of the, the private sector surveys seem to indicate that that's the case. And, the whole idea was to buy states some amount of time to prepare for what would come next, because a lockdown only postpones the problem. The lockdown doesn't solve the problem. And certainly a fair amount of preparation has happened in the period of the 2 or 3 weeks. But it's still unclear what the end game for COVID is going to look like, because it's too late to put this genie back in the bottle and send it out. It's just not possible. Probably too many cases involved. But it's not going to also be a situation where we can easily get to the end by having, continuous lockdowns forever and forever. So I think other countries are going to face the same issue, China as well, Europe also to some extent, and of course the U.S. So this is going to be a conundrum. How do we really play the long game of COVID now that we've maybe not been completely wiped out in a short game? And that's where India finds itself. And the indications are that that states in India, which also have considerable voice, and which are not of the same ruling party as in the center, are not really sure that they want to open up just yet, because they're acutely aware that their health systems are not really prepared for what's coming up. There's obviously a lot of heterogeneity in India because some of the southern states in Maharashtra and Punjab have really good health systems, relatively speaking. They probably, Kerala, of course, is as good as, many advanced countries, or these cities in advanced countries. Things like Bihar and Chhattisgarh are as badly off as Sierra Leone. So you've got all of that contained in a single country, and it's not clear how one would tackle this problem in some sort of a coordinated fashion, because obviously what happens in one state has consequences for other states as well. So that's just a brief introduction, and I can talk more about India's health system and capacity if there are questions about it, but this is the COVID situation in India this time.
Thank you. That was a great overview. I'd actually like to follow up with something that you spoke about a little bit. If you can give us a little bit more detail on the testing situation, because it seems that India has really begun to ramp up the testing only recently, including by pulling in the private sector. Can you talk a little bit about how this transpired? Where is the testing going? It seems, by all accounts, that actually the most important thing needed to be able to get back to a normal life economically is going to be having that testing capacity.
Yeah, I mean, even the U.S. doesn't have testing capacity. You think of India, which has four times the population and far fewer RT-PCR machines. Testing capacity is a challenge. And then we've got to think about what we're using testing for. So I think the thinking going forward would have to be along some lines of the following, along the following direction, which is we've got to make sure that we're getting the testing for early identification of the elderly population who are most at risk. So that's where a lot of the RT-PCR will actually be going. We'll probably use, some states have already announced that they might use pooled RT-PCR. Basically, you pool samples from multiple patients and then you're able to identify clusters of infections. And you use that for community containment. And side by side, we really need to do the serology to see who, you know, the proportion that has experienced the infection and has seroconverted. And therefore, that would allow us to know how much of India has actually experienced the infection without actually going through a symptomatic phase. Now, if you think of the positives for India, the big positive for India is that it has a relatively young population. So only about 6.5 or 7% of India's population is above the age of 65, which is astounding if you think of it. Even China, that proportion is about, you know, 11 or 12%. For Italy, that proportion is 22%, which means theoretically India could achieve herd immunity. I mean, I say theoretically because obviously the you know, making it happen requires a whole other, you know, kind of game. It could achieve herd immunity without a single person above the age of 65 actually being infected. And that just means that the virus gets knocked out because it's running into too many immunes who are not going to be good carriers for the disease. Now, that's those are the advantages for India, but we won't know that until we have a serological survey, which we don't really have for any country at this point just yet. So it's not just testing. It's also testing for community containment using the real-time PCR. It's also a question of having the serology testing, which at least in my opinion is probably the most important thing that India could be doing right now.
How far away is India from being able to do the serology testing?
It's probably a week or so away. I mean, it's a receiving high priority, and in fact, after I get off this call, I'm going to make slides for the government on the sampling frame and so forth. So this comes, yeah. So this is high on their priority list.
It's near term. It's not 2 months. Let me follow up on another issue that you raised, which was the fact that India does have a federal system and you've got different kinds of healthcare capacity in different states. Can you give a little bit more detailed landscape of what that means for our participants on the call?
So India has a largely privately paid system, and the poor go to the public system. But the public system has been systematically underfunded for a very long time. India spends only about 1.4% of GDP on public funds for health. Overall, it adds up to about 4.5%, but that's including, you know, private out-of-pocket payments. So in many ways, as hard as it is to imagine, India is a more privately paid system than even the U.S., which you think of as a largely privately paid system. At least the U.S. has Medicare and Medicaid, and India doesn't have that kind of a system just yet, although the Ayushman Bharat is really meant to be that for the poor. Now, the number of doctors is a major constraint. There are only about 600,000 GPs, about 800,000, you know, medical doctors in India. Of those, three quarters are in the urban areas, the urban centers. So you have an overall ratio of doctors to patients of 1 per 1,600 people across India. But that ratio looks a lot more like the U.S., which is 1 to 500 in the urban centers, and it looks much more like sub-Saharan Africa when you look at rural India, where the ratio would be 1 per 8,000 or 1 per 10,000, which is the national average for Kenya, for instance. So huge divide right there. Number of hospital beds, again, most of these hospital beds, 2.3 beds per 1,000 population, only 100,000 ICU beds. Most of these are just in the urban centers. So if you're not in one of those urban centers, you're totally out of luck in terms of getting either getting the professional that you need, which I think is the first step, or then the bed that you need. So these are, you know, it's difficult. A senior bureaucrat from Kerala, which is probably our best state in terms of health and education, you know, said recently you can't build a public health system to tackle an emergency in the middle of the emergency. And, you know, he's absolutely right. We are struggling in places like UP and Bihar because how in the world do you put in place a system in the middle of, you know, what's already a massive, you know, crisis, and how well can you in 2 weeks round up the doctors and the nurses and the infection control protocols and the beds and the ventilators and the oxygen flow masks and the oxygen cylinders and everything else that you need to make the system work, it's pretty difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly why people are worried about how this may unfold further in India. We have a lot of people who are on the call. Todd, can you provide instructions for how people can ask a question, and then we can probably turn to open things up?
Yes. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you were using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions.
And let me just follow up with one question of my own again before we take the first call question from our participants. The issue of air quality. This has been something that people have mentioned as something that contributes to someone's vulnerability to COVID-19. Can you speak a little bit about that? Is that what you're seeing so far in India, or is there just not yet enough data?
So there's not yet enough data. So first of all, if you look at the age profile of deaths from COVID in India, the average profile looks like the Italian profile shifted down 20 years, right? So we actually have younger people die, and that's possibly because obviously a lot of people in India are young, so that's possibly some of it. But the other part is also, this notion of immune age. When people are subject to bad air quality, there's a high rate of smoking, there's poor nutrition, all of these mean that it's actually not the case that, Indians are less susceptible to infections. If anything, they're more susceptible to infections. And we don't know how that's going to play out. So that's one big unknown. A second big unknown is seasonality. We don't really have good data to know how much the heat and humidity are going to help us out in India, whether it follows a flu season kind of a track. So if that does, that gives us a bit of a reprieve, for the next few months. But unclear how that plays out. We're also not sure about how the virus itself evolves. I mean, India is a massive country, and if you really think about it, this is where the virus is really going to get shaped in terms of virulence and so forth. And to some extent, the lockdown and the distancing in India could have an effect on how the virus itself evolves. So there are many, many unknowns here, and as it is, even on the global scale, we're learning stuff literally every few hours, forget about every day. So there was a study out of Harvard from Francesca Domenici on air quality that, U.S. Counties which had bad air quality were more likely to see COVID deaths. But, of course, that's a bit challenging because there's a lot of confounding. I mean, places that have bad air quality also have other characteristics that make people, more likely to maybe not have access to health care or something else that would make them more likely to die. So the science is still evolving on this, but just as a matter of common sense, it seems as if, if you look at a respiratory infection, which is essentially, manifesting as an acute respiratory distress syndrome, that having, these sort of insults to the lungs would not be a good idea in terms of outcomes.
Thank you. Todd, can we take our first question?
Yes, we'll take our first question from Marshall Belton with Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
Dr. Lakshmi Narayan, and thank you for, and Todd, thank you both for the comments. I wanted to follow up on two related aspects of this. The first is, I think just as little as a week ago, the Union Health Ministers denied that there was any community transmission in India. And said we're still basically looking at a cluster vector in terms of the spread of the disease, and that the lockdown might enable that vector to be confined or to be kept as the principal means of transmission. I'd like to have you comment on that. And relatedly, there's I just listened to a talk by Zeke Emanuel at the University of Pennsylvania, where he describes the likely course of disease in virtually every country to greater or lesser extent as a roller coaster. with a high peak followed by a somewhat lower peak followed by a somewhat lower peak. And the question is then, are we going to get rebounds once different countries open up to different degrees? And what are the prospects for that in India? Thank you.
Did I answer that or wait for another one?
Please go ahead and answer it. We'll go. I think we should probably take a question and you can answer because not all the questions are likely to be the same.
Sure. So I'll try to be brief. So the second the point that was made out of the University of Pennsylvania, that's absolutely what a disease model would predict, and that's going to be true for many countries. So I think as all of us think forward, regardless of country, we're going to think of what that end state is going to look like. And that end state either ends with a vaccine that comes on board soon enough, and we're able to protect the population against mass infection. Or we say we try to achieve herd immunity, but not in a UK sort of a model, but really in much more of a controlled, I tend to think of this as, when you're skidding and you're driving your car and there's ice, you apply the brakes sort of repeatedly rather than all at once, because then you spin out of control and then you really don't have the option of regaining it. We might have to do repeated lockdowns over a period of time in multiple countries, and that's just a hypothesis based on what the disease models really look like. But I would agree with the fact that this is only, as someone else put it, you know, the first innings of nine, so we have a long way to go. On the first one, it's a bit of semantics. I mean, the Indian government is also trying to manage expectations and fear factor amongst the population. And the fear and panic are indeed serious problems, serious enough that people have been, you know, throwing stones at doctors thinking that they carry the virus or, what have you. So there's a lot of ignorance there. So they're trying to sort of manage this by developing their own definitions of what community transmission is. And now they said that community transmission in their book would be when at least 30 or 40% of the cases that they get reported come from the community without a trace back to an original COVID case or back to an instance of foreign travel. I think that's much more, how shall I put it, it's public health communications that the government wants to do. There is no such thing as a community transmission in a WHO sort of a definition of things. And if you would ask me when there was transmission broadly in the community, it probably started in early March. And that's for no fault of India or the Indian government. This is just a highly contagious virus. There's literally no country in the world that can control this from happening. So it's not a failure. It's just that's what we're up against.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Teresita Schaefer with McClarity Associates.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about lockdowns in India. You were, Dr. Lakshmi Narayan, you were quite optimistic about how the lockdowns had worked in terms of people playing by the rules. My question is more fundamental than that. When you have a large urban population that probably live in pretty crowded quarters, how effective can a lockdown be?
You know, that's a great question. And remember, what we're trying to do with these is to limit the opportunities for transmission to happen. So every instance that you can reduce of it means that you're slowing it down. It doesn't mean that you've done 100%, but if you've shut down, movie theaters, if you've shut down workplaces, if you've shut down weddings, mass gatherings, sure, you've not managed to control it in places where people live in close proximity. At least a lot of the large transmission has been shut down. So certainly there are going to be pockets where transmission will continue, like in slums and housing colonies, places where people live close to each other or non-compliant, maybe in rural areas. But that said, the preponderance of compliance has been quite evident. So it's really all these other things that didn't happen. And on average, the transmission, the number of secondary infections that one infected person generates, has definitely come down. And that's all we can really do. It can't be perfect, because if we can literally make everyone stand 6 feet apart from everyone else for a period of 3 weeks, on the planet, that will be the end of COVID.
Can I just follow up quickly on Ambassador Schaefer's question? We saw, I think, news today that Mumbai has announced that community transmission is definitely taking place in Mumbai, and there have been some cases in Marathi where it's not possible for people to distance themselves. What does this suggest for how to provide appropriate care and to try to improve the ability to stop transmission in such truly dense housing circumstances?
You know, I think the honest answer is it's going to be pretty darn impossible. If you take a place like Dharavi, the three things that they could possibly do is section it out into multiple sections, do food RT-PCR and figure out the sections with the highest rates of infection, and then, you know, try to focus social messaging, messages on distancing as much as they possibly can, but really be prepared for a bigger outbreak in these slums and have the healthcare facilities ready to tackle these. At some point, we can't actually control everything about this epidemic because, you know, it's life as it's given to us. It's as Ambassador Schaefer said, it's really, you know, you can't stop transmission in these places. That's just how it's going to be. In which case, we're going to have to take some of this on the chin and have the facilities ready for the healthcare when the moderate cases come out, when the severe cases come out, because that's just going to be our journey for the next, I mean, I say ours as in everyone in the world's journey for the next, you know, 6 months or 8 months or what have you. So I agree. There are places where you just won't be able to stop transmission. I mean, short of pulling everyone out and putting them in a quarantine facility, and even there would be transmission. So these are real challenges. I don't think there's an easy answer yet.
Todd, our next question.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Badanan Dumi with American Enterprise Institute.
Hello. Well, thank you, Dr. Lakshminarayan, for your very cogent comment. I also have a question on the lockdown. Now, if I understood your comments correctly, you suggested that community transmission had already probably begun by early March, and by the time the lockdown was announced, your estimation is that there was probably something like 21,000 cases as opposed to the official number, which at that time was about only 500 cases. If that's the case, and we've all seen these media reports of many thousands of people streaming out from urban India after the lockdown was announced and heading into their homes in villages across the country, how can we be confident that the lockdown has not, in fact, speeded up the community transmission instead of shutting it down?
You know, that's a great point and something that does worry me. And this is one of the parts which I feel that I wish the government had thought of the migrant workers before. They did address the problem afterwards when it became quite apparent to the media, but it was something that they really should have just planned for before. And you're absolutely right. Now, the only, not a counter-argument, what I would hope for is that because the disease primarily entered through people who are of middle class or wealthier, that the poor were not that exposed to the disease in the early stages for the first 2-3 weeks, because this was still transmitting, you know, primarily through people, you know, and there's a lot of class-based cohorting effect and age-based cohorting. Contacts are much better, you know, closer between people of the same age and people of the same class as it is in many other countries. So my only hope is that the prevalence in that migrant population was hopefully not large, and if it was not large, then hopefully it didn't damage too much in terms of rural India. But of course, this is just hypothesis, and we'll have to see how it plays out.
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Sanjeev Mehra with Paraphys Capital.
Thank you, Dr. Lakshminarayan. Thank you for your comments. My question relates to reports in the media of a group of religious leaders getting together in New Delhi in the midst of this social distancing effort, and over 1,000 people apparently, who have since been dispersed and have gone back to other locations. How big an impact do you think this will have on the spread?
So India was under testing anyway, and so these folks, so just so that everyone knows, this is a sect of Muslims called Tablighis, and they happened to have a convention which they had organized at a time when there were no actual restrictions on Hindi leaving. They had people coming from abroad, from Indonesia and other countries, Malaysia and other countries. And the day that this curfew was set in place, there were 2,000 of them holed up in one building in Old Delhi. And, of course, they all dispersed to other parts of the country before the rails shut down. And then subsequently, they were found to have transmitted the disease to every corner of the country, over 1,000 cases, and I think to date about 17 deaths just from that one explosion. Now, see, my point is, yes, do I wish it had not happened? Absolutely. Do we know that has not happened in other instances that have not come to light? I mean, you know, India is a complex country. It's large. It's hard to know what's going on with 1.4 billion people. And this could have happened in other ways as well. All of these kinds of explosions of many epidemics are what we consider these models to sort of say that, the reproductive number or the ease of transmission in India is always going to be higher than it is in other places, like in France and Germany. It's just because people's distance from other people just physically is a lot greater in all respects. And this all feeds into that kind of an average. So it's hard to know how much this alone contributes to the epidemic. I would suspect it's not going to be that significant. Obviously, it shows up in the official numbers because these guys do get tested. But I think the bigger questions are really going to be around asymptomatic. I mean, if India does a serology survey and finds that a lot of people have actually experienced infection or are already asymptomatic, that would be the kind of good news that I'd like to share, because that just means that we haven't taken a big hit in terms of cases or deaths, even if they were underreported right now. But at least we're closer on the pathway to getting to, immunity at a broader scale. So there's a lot of unknowns here, to be sure. And this is, again, the attributable impact of this is certainly a big unknown.
Our next question.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 now. We'll take our next question from Mansoor Shams with Muslim Marine.
Yes, hello. I guess what I wanted to understand was, how is India working to prevent misinformation and people not taking the virus seriously, particularly like through venues of WhatsApp and Facebook? Being a Pakistani background myself, I get these random forwarded messages that are coming to me all the time, the distance of the cure, and so on. And then the second part of misinformation, that this was a virus that was created in a lab in the United States or in China in an effort to achieve further global power. Thank you.
You know, in India and Pakistan, it's actually the same. I think this is basically the same problem. People have, lots of time on their hands on lockdown. They're either spending it on Twitter, or on watching movies, or of course on WhatsApp forward. So it's a dangerous time, from all of those perspectives. And certainly when I talk to, to my gardener, for instance, he is convinced that this is a Chinese plot to wipe out the rest of the world. Or it depends on who you talk to. There's a section of the Muslim population that chased out healthcare workers because they were convinced it was a plot to make them impotent. So there's all kinds of rumors floating around there, and I think the government is trying to do what it can, but of course it doesn't have control over information flow, particularly on WhatsApp. So this is, what can I say? I think this is a global phenomenon, and even at the best of times, there's nonsense going around, and at times like this, it just multiplies many times over.
Dr. Lakshmi Narayan, that actually suggests to me the question of, what are you aware of that's being done on the kind of social media or tech side to try to promote real information and do away with or debunk this kind of false information?
So, you know, to the extent possible, so there are two ways in which it's being addressed. I think there's a lot of positive social media stuff. There's a lot of positive communication by state. You know, there are cops in every city that are basically, you know, putting out these messages on a constant basis. I have to say that I've been quite impressed at the response by government in terms of how seriously they're taking this and how well they're responding, even on the social media stuff. But, you know, you can't control what goes out on WhatsApp, and that's something which has a life of its own, and, you know, certainly I hear about a lot of these sort of, you know, all of these theories going around, and some of them start from, you know, pretty high up, like the whole chloroquine story or BCG or, you know, that, you know, what have you. There are so many things, right? And this is not a time when people have the time to listen to scientific experts. Everyone has their own theory, and literally everybody has a PhD in COVID from WhatsApp University at this point. So what can you say?
You mentioned BCG. Can you speak a little bit about that for our participants?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert on this. I mean, I just know the literature from before that BCG does have a generalized impact on reducing the prevalence of other infections for reasons that we don't really know. These have always been ecological studies. But the idea that BCG is protective against infections other than miliary TB is not so wacky, because there's been some studies on this. They've all typically come from the same group, so never been replicated, but at least the idea has been around there before. What I find perplexing about this idea that countries that have universal BCG are somehow protected from other countries is that, you know, many of the countries that don't do universal BCG now, like Germany, for instance, did actually do universal BCG before. So, and I forget about Italy, I think they probably have universal BCG as well. So the relevant data point is whether people had gotten a BCG shot when they were younger, if they were like 65 years old now. Then I would believe that it's protective, because looking at current BCG guidelines and saying that somehow that is protective to some countries doesn't seem to make sense to me, and I have to admit, I'm certainly not an expert on this, but generally, if I were to get a paper on something like this, I would be very skeptical about accepting it, just because it's a classical ecological study with all the ecological fallacies that would make, you know, drawing any sort of a conclusion quite problematic.
And the other one, obviously, President Trump has been speaking daily about hydroxychloroquine. India is a big producer of hydroxychloroquine. Can you also talk a little bit about who's taking that, if at all, is being recommended in India, or are people reserving judgment on it for the time being?
So actually, hydroxychloroquine has been recommended by the Indian Council of Medical Research for healthcare workers, and not everyone in India is sure that that was such a good idea, because the benefit-cost ratio for chloroquine in the time of malaria was very different. I mean, there were, you know, it has this exacerbating effect on arrhythmias, and that's fine if you're preventing people from dying of a deadly malaria infection. For an uncertain benefit, but for a certain actual population-level risk, it's not clear that you'd want to do it. And I think that's why Dr. Fauci doesn't want to, you know, say anything more about it, because it's simply unproven that way. And even if the benefit were really small, there are actually some known risks associated with chloroquine. Sure, you know, when you had malaria, you know, being highly prevalent, it was mixed in with common salt in some countries, and it was given out at a population of lax cases. But it was very different back then. You know, people didn't have a lot. The rates of heart disease were not that high back then. People didn't live that long. So the calculus is very different right now, and I would trust WHO or NIAID to issue the appropriate guidance here, and since neither of them has recommended either hydroxychloroquine or the combination of the erythromycin, I would stick with what they have to say.
Todd, do we have any questions?
I'm sorry,
oh,
Alyssa,
sure.
Do you mind if I ask a quick follow-up on that question? I completely agree with the assessment. I wanted to ask about the use of export restrictions. With the government having threatened one over the weekend or tried to impose one and then at least partially back down, obviously India plays an important role in the pharmaceutical supply chain generally, particularly for poorer countries. Do you see what has happened with exports controls in this instance somehow being suggestive of what might come in the future, particularly if we get to the point where we have the need for low-cost therapeutics once one is proven to be effective, or even if we get to the point of vaccines? I know people have been hoping the Serum Institute of India might have been one of the manufacturing centers for production of a vaccine at scale.
So I think these companies are already gearing up for precisely those scenarios. There are four Indian companies, including IPCA, which is the biggest one that makes chloroquine. And, you know, some of it is short-term posturing because India said they wouldn't export it, and then they quickly turned around and they said, well, we'll export it to countries that were really in need. Obviously, there's only a few countries that are actually demanding the drug, and the U.S. is one of them. And then, of course, there's been the back and forth between President Trump and India on this. So I wouldn't take any of that stuff really seriously because in a longer term sense, I think the Indian manufacturers do have the capacity to scale up production of generics quite significantly and also for vaccines. And I think they are looking at the opportunity for a coronavirus vaccine when it does come on board to play a role, but not just Serum. Bharat Biotech is another company that makes the coronavirus vaccine that is sold widely. There's probably a few companies which would all be in that situation. So I wouldn't look at the short-term perturbations of the last week as indicative in any way of India sort of not wanting to play that role of providing drugs and vaccines to the world.
Todd, did you have a follow-up, or should we go to the next question? Maybe we'll go to the next question. Todd?
Thank you. We'll take our next question from Marshall Boughton with Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
Thank you, Dr. Lashinaran, and it's for the end of the hour allotted, and I wanted to ask you to look ahead. So at least my lay reading of, you know, a combined sort of opinion of epidemiologists and people like Bill Gates and others who are all cautioning us that at least in the United States, we can't really think of anything returning to anything approaching normalcy or normality until the latter half of 2021 at the earliest. And that projection is, of course, entangled with the expectations of when we might get a vaccine produced at scale for global distribution. And apparently the key possibility for that is what J&J is working on in terms of the antibodies. So could you share with us your thinking at this point, recognizing all the uncertainties you've described so well, for what might be the timetable in India?
You know, I think if you were to ask, again, disease modelers, and I'm sure that the data is informed by those as well. A big unknown for us is how rapidly the disease is transmitting amongst asymptomatics. We had, you know, this again comes down.
Sorry, we lost our speaker. Please remain on the line. Just one moment.
Oh, I'm so sorry that happened. One of the risks of moving a roundtable discussion to conference call.
Well, you could count that as a vote for not anytime soon, I guess.
I think we've all got to worry about everywhere, but the challenge in India is just so enormous. We're obviously focusing on this call.
Yeah.
This call is
much more
focused. Yes, please. Terrific. We lost you. Please continue.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. I don't know what happened there. So I think a big question is how fast the population is getting exposed in a very quiet way, and through the spread of asymptomatics, which is probably likely amongst the younger population, especially the 5 to 50-year-old population, which doesn't exhibit severe symptoms. So I think we'll know a lot more on this as more of these serology studies are conducted, because that will enable us to parameterize these models to be a lot better. And what we should all hope for, whether in the U.S. or in India, is that we hope to have a lot of asymptomatics and a lot of population exposure and seroconversion, you know, and relatively few cases in death. And if we can keep one up and one down, then that's what we would hope for. If we do these serological studies and find that actually not many have been exposed, but we still have incurred this huge cost in terms of cases and death, that would just be bad news for us. And then that's what I would look at as the end of 2021 kind of a scenario, or whenever the vaccine arrives, whichever comes first. So there's still a lot of unknowns with respect to the disease, and again, the temperature and humidity, which I fully admit, we have no evidence to suggest that it's going to slow down because of the heat or humidity. But, you know, one can hope. Respiratory viruses do have a habit of sort of, you know, showing some seasonality. And so I think we've known this virus really only since mid-January, which is really extremely short, just about 2.5 months. And I suspect that another month or 2 months from now, we'll know far more in terms of how it behaves. And maybe it's not going to be as dire as it seems right now.
Thank you.
We're almost to the end of our time, and I'm going to try to ask a very quick question in our last 2 minutes. Dr. Lakshmi Narayan, when we think about a kind of rolling opening, or we've seen now some of the press and some of the debate in India is about how to open up, how to kind of phase an opening and end the lockdown in a way that won't create more transmission but will allow the economy to restart. I mean, the question that raises for me is, you know, cities are the economic engines, and they're also the spaces of population density. How do you envision a kind of gradual opening that will allow the economy to restart? Because the economic piece is so important.
You know, that's a great question. In India's context, remember that over half of the population really depends on agriculture. So in terms of the trade-off is not lives versus the economy in India like it is in the U.S. It's really lives versus lives. We definitely don't want to have mass deaths from hunger and starvation and from rural impoverishment, at the cost of protecting people wherever they might be against COVID. That would be a terrible mistake. So I think that opening up rural India to the extent possible by providing the healthcare support and the testing to enable that part of the population to get moving, because the density is not going to be as great as in urban India, would be probably the priority. And then for urban India, which again, I think that part of India would take, in India, it's referred to as India and Bharat. Bharat is the Hindi word in India, and Bharat is the rural India, and in India is the urban India that speaks English and so forth. And the India part of India is actually, will take a hit economically. I think the projection is that it'll be a 2.5% growth rate. I think that's pretty optimistic given what I've seen around in terms of distress in the corporate sector. So that part will take a hit, but that's the part will, just by virtue of the fact, as you correctly said, has density and ease of transmission, will have to bear the brunt of lockdowns, which are more periodic, to slow down and put some brakes on the virus every now and then. But for me personally, I think the bigger concern is we shouldn't cause people to go hungry and starve to death because they were trying to save other lives because of COVID, and that's really a major concern for many people in India right now.
They're just terribly difficult choices. This is something that we've really never seen before to this extent. We are at the end of our time. It is 12:31 our time, and in case people weren't aware, Dr. Lakshmi Narayan is participating from New Delhi, so it's got quite late over there for him. Can I thank Dr. Lakshmi Narayan and my colleague Tom Boyke for participating today, making us all a lot smarter about what's happening in India with this coronavirus pandemic, the vulnerabilities, and India's response. Thanks so much, and thanks to all the participants for joining us today, and I hope to keep continuing to convene the roundtable series, either by conference call or by video conference. Thank you, and everyone stay safe and healthy.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.